Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This episode of True Murder is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Start a free trial today, no credit card required. Experience Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code TRUEMURDER for a 10% discount. Jack the Ripper stalked the streets of London's East End from August through November of 1888 in what is dubbed the Autumn of Terror. However, the grisly ripping of Polly Nichols on August 31st was not the first unsolved murder of the year. The April murder of Emma Smith and the August murder of Martha Tabram both occurred on bank holidays. They baffled the police and press alike, and were assumed by the original investigators to have been the first murders in the series. Were they correct? In this provocative work of literary archaeology, author Tom Westcott places these early murders in their proper historical context and digs to unearth new evidence and hard facts not seen in over 125 years. The Bank Holiday Murders is the only book of its kind. It eschews the tired approach of unsatisfying final solutions in favor of solid research, logical reasoning, and new information. The clues followed are not drawn from imagination, but from the actual police reports and press accounts of the time. The questions asked by Westcott are ones first suggested by the original investigators, but lost to time until now. The answers provided are compelling and sometimes explosive. Among the revelations are new information linking the murders of Smith and Tabram to the same killer or killers. Proof that the police did not believe key witnesses in either case. Proof that at least one of these witnesses working with the murderer. New evidence connecting many of the victims that may lead to their actual slayers. Information on Emily Horsnell, the actual first Whitechapel murder victim. The hidden truth of Leather Apron and its role in unraveling the Ripper mystery. Proof of a corrupt police sergeant who thwarted the investigation. Was he protecting the Ripper? The book that we're featuring this evening is The Bank Holiday Murders, the true story of the first Whitechapel murders, with my special guest, journalist and author, Tom Westcott. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Tom Westcott.
Hello, can you hear me?
Absolutely. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Well, good to thank you for having me, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. You scheduled Once Upon a Time, so I'm glad that we finally got you on here with this compelling book that, again, talks about Jack the Ripper, but you have a very, very unique perspective on this. Before we start, for our audience, and I didn't want to call you a ripperologist because I don't really know who wants to be called that and exactly what that means. But exactly, tell us your background involving all things Ripper and Jack the Ripper, and tell us your background and how, without giving anything away, how you came to write this book with this particular perspective surrounding Jack the Ripper.
Sure, sure. Well, I personally, I don't shy away from the word ripperologist. I don't feel any sort of negative connotation from it. I think for a time there, 10 years ago or so, it was sort of a fringe, you know, name people shied away from it. But nowadays, because there's the journal of our field is called Ripperologist, and it's a highly, highly respected journal. It's also free. You know, anyone can subscribe to it. So I'm proud of that title. I got into Ripperology back in the 90s, just by accident. I think it's, you know, it says bug that bites you is what it is. And I picked up a book in a used bookstore, a Ripper book, that happened to be misplaced in the horror fiction section, and which is what I went there looking for. It was a horror fiction book. And I found this nonfiction book on the Ripper and just grabbed it on a lark. And I went home and I read it and I said, you know, is this really the solution? And then it was the burgeoning days of the internet. I looked on there, found the Casebook website, which is the big Ripper website, one of two big Ripper websites, and saw there were all these other books. So I started checking them out at the library or buying them, and it was just one thing after another. What happens when you do this, and people who read Ripper books will recognize this in themselves, the more you read, the more naturally you're going to learn. You're going to remember details, and then you're going to notice when authors make mistakes or when they get a detail, look at it from a different angle from someone else, and you start developing your own opinions and thoughts and ideas along the way. And next thing you know, you're researching those to see if you're right and they're wrong. And then that's kind of how this thing, and it just snowballs from there and until, you know, eventually you've got a room of your house filled with Ripper books and magazines and old, you know, 126-year-old newspapers. And then at some point, in my case, it was, you know, my research led me into certain avenues that were new. Because I didn't want to just be there's a lot of Ripper books out there that are crap. That's just, there's so many of them that's just by nature, there's going to be a portion of them that are just a waste of money. I personally think that's probably about 70% of the books out there fit into that category. And then another 20% are decent, you know, they're harmless. And then maybe 5 to 10% are, you know, really you got to have them books. And so I wanted to put something out that fit into that 5%. Whether I succeeded or failed, you know, will be up to the individual perspective. I think I succeeded because the majority of stuff in my book does not appear in other books in terms of how I interpret it, and also new evidence presented that hasn't appeared in books before. The first Ripper or the first Whitechapel murder, which Emily Horsnell, I don't believe her name has ever appeared in a Ripper book until mine. So, but anyways, there you go. The short answer to your question is I got into it not really by choice. It's just a bug that bit me and it stayed with me. And by accident and luck more than anything else, I've stumbled on some things that I thought other people who interested in the case should know. And that's where this book came from.
You talk about in this book that you it's not a typical book in terms of final solution, in terms of wrapping up the entire mystery and saying conclusively, here is the killer and here it is. But in writing this book, you also were looking at a different project. So tell us who you were looking at in terms of a suspect. Talk about this Charles LeBrand. And tell us about how it morphed into looking at this person to the focus of the project here with the bank holiday murders.
Well, one of the suspects who intrigues me more than anyone and who is not discussed in the bank holiday murders, I'll say that up front, but his name is Charles LeGrand. He is the subject of a future book of mine, which myself and fellow researchers, primarily a lady named Deborah Arup, has researched extensively over the last decade. But he has never had a book dedicated to him. This guy, Charles LeGrand, in a nutshell, is a sociopath, psychopath, very dangerous. He was a pimp. He instigated himself into the Ripper investigation following the murder of Elizabeth Stride. He fabricated evidence, threw the police off track, almost certainly wrote the what's called the From Hell letter, and was cited by a certain member of Parliament as being the man most likely in London to have been Jack the Ripper. And yet, you know, he doesn't have a book about him. So I'm going to write that book because I've got a lot of cool stuff on him. But so anyways, I decided I'm going to write this book on Charles LeGrand. But before my idea was this. I didn't want to do another suspect book. I never wanted to do that. So my idea was I'm going to start at square one, the first murder, which at that time I thought was Emma Smith. And I'm going to research without bias from scratch, starting at square one and work my way forward through all the murders, putting Charles LeGrand out of my mind, leaving myself open to any new avenues or interpretations. And lo and behold, you know, by the time I hit Martha Tabram, the second of the official Whitechapel murders, I'm noticing things, chiefly surrounding this character, Pearlie Paul, who is allegedly a friend of Martha Tabram's. Things weren't adding up in her statement and in the evidence. And so I said, well, let me follow this. And I started following this, and it led me to the landlords, the guys who really held the power in the East End of London. Yeah, back in 1888, you know, probably more so, they had more sway over the public than the police did. That's power. That's power right there. And so it led me back to them, and I started looking at them, and just kind of, I said, wait a minute, what was supposed to be a couple chapters of a book is my notes and all of this were ballooning. I'm like, I can't cover this in like two, you know, 10-page chapters. I've got about 200 pages in front of me. This is a book in its own right, and it needs to be considered in its own right, aside from anything else I want to talk about. Those can wait for other books. And so that's when I started writing the Bank Holiday Murders in a fever pitch back in October of 2013, and actually finished it in January of 2014, just a few months later, and then published it the following month. And at that time, I thought, well, this is just a little book, you know, the devotees to the case will purchase it, and it's actually become it's done very well for me, actually, surprisingly so. Over the last year, it's performed very well, and the feedback I've gotten has been tremendous, and it's just been an utter joy for me.
Well, that's great. That's very deserved too. Let's set the stage here. I know that a lot of people have read Ripper books, and probably a lot of the audience knows of the basic premise or the story behind the Ripper mythology and the basic story. But really what I found most fascinating about your book is how sucked in I got into this book due to the descriptions you have of the East End of London in 1888 and surrounding years. And you talked about, you alluded to the, which is very, very important to your whole story, is the lodging houses. So Tell us about the lodging houses, and tell us about the owners, some of the names like John McCarthy, and some of the names of the lodging houses, and how it worked with people that were managers of those houses. Tell us, I want to really set the stage to describe London at this time, what these people were living in and the circumstances. So tell us first with the lodging houses, and then we'll get to the character of some of these men and just the conditions that these people lived in these lodging houses.
Sure. Well, first, let me say thank you, Dan, for the kind words about the book. I certainly appreciate that, particularly coming from you. And the landlords, or I call them the Lords of Spitalfields in my book, the East End of London where these murders occurred were essentially a slumland. Not all of it was. There were very respectable people who lived there, hardworking people. But in the lodging houses, just to put it into a context that a modern American could quickly grasp, just think, you know, the projects, project housing. And today in our society, the slumlords are the government, because the government owns these housing, they run it, and they profit from it. But that wasn't the case in 1888 London. The government did not step in and do anything at all for these people. So the landlords were essentially low-rent businessmen who came in, bought these old dilapidated houses, and rented out beds, not rooms, but beds. You might have a room with 50 beds in it. All, you know, the sheets and the clothing may not get washed regularly. They're just completely covered in vermin and lice, blood. You know, that's what you're going to sleep in. And then you're going to track this, and you're going to carry this to the next house with you. And it's just over and over and over again. There would be a communal kitchen with a fire, where you could roast your potatoes. Surprisingly, people didn't really starve back then. Food was cheap and plentiful. It really was. You know, what money you didn't really have to set aside too much money for the food. In fact, you could probably get a lot of it for free because your money was going for beer. But wherever there is poverty and desperation, there will always be those who want to come in and capitalize on it and profit from it. And in this case, it was the landlords who not only made money off of their rent, because these were homeless people, essentially, who were coming and paying a nightly DOS, as it was called, to sleep in one of these beds. But you were also a fence for stolen property. These people would often say, "Hey, Dan, I don't have money for my bed, but I have this that I stole today." So you would take that instead, and you would then sell that to the pawn shop or sell it through a pawn shop that you owned. A lot of these landlords also owned local pubs, and the East End of London was crawling with pubs at that time. Alcohol was the crack and the meth of its day. That's what everyone was addicted to in the East End. That was the predominant drug. So if you owned a pub, boy, you were never out of money. So were these bad men? Not all of them. A lot of them were. A lot of them just maybe had less scruples than you or I would. But at the same time, the other way to look at it is if they weren't there running these homes, these people had nowhere to sleep because there was no one else to help them. The Salvation Army, which, by the way, was given birth by Jack the Ripper, more or less. It was beginning just at that very time, and they were just opening up rooms. And the Salvation Army was born from the East End of London, 1888. And Jack the Ripper brought attention to the plight of the people in this area, and so everyone started giving money to the Salvation Army, and that's how it got its original funding and got its footing and became what we know today. So that's a little interesting tidbit. But all the victims of Jack the Ripper or the Whitechapel murderer, lived in these houses. And anyone who's read my book or goes to read it will notice that I discuss some startling coincidences, and I say that with quotation marks, such as that the first, you have a number of women in a row who are attacked and or murdered who all lived in neighboring houses. Two houses on George Street, numbers 18 and 19. You have Emily Horsnell murdered. My mind's going blank on me. But another lady who's been attacked and survives, but spends 20 days in the hospital, followed by Emma Smith, murdered, followed by Martha Tabram, murdered, all between November of 1887 and August of 1888. So in that period, now that's an awful lot. And you say, well, in a violent area like that, the thing is murders were extremely rare in the East End of London. When you saw a murder, it was typically domestic. It was a man killing his wife. 9 times out of 10, that's what it was. Stranger murders such as this were exceedingly rare. And to have that many violent attacks and murders occur to women living in two neighboring houses, I thought, okay, that's just pushing coincidence a little too much. And I noticed one character who was living in one of these houses at the time was Pearlie Paul, which was a 35-year-old prostitute, manly-looking, husky, she was described, suffered from chest complaints her whole life, and basically a criminal well-known to the police. Anyway, she presented herself to the police following the murder of Martha Tabram and told a wild story, which they believed at first, but then came to understand was a lie. And the thing is she went to the police and identified the body correctly. The body had not been identified yet as Martha Tabram, but somehow she knew that's who was murdered and already had a fake story made up. And I thought, okay, this is highly suspicious. This is something somebody does if they're wanting to either get themselves or someone else off the hook by casting the police's suspicion in a different direction, which is what she did. She tried to claim that Martha Tabram spent her last hours in the company of herself and two soldiers. And all these identity parades followed to try and find these men. Of course, they never existed. And that's what I discuss in my book. So then I have the question of, okay, who was Pearlie Paul lying to protect? And that's what led me to the landlords. Now, Pearly Paul moves from that house. Following the murder of Martha Tabram, she moves to another house, 35 Dorset Street. And, you know, within a couple weeks, Polly Nichols is murdered, who resides at 35 Dorset Street. Polly Nichols being the first of the what's called the canonical Ripper victims.
Right.
She's not the first Whitechapel murder victim. She's the first Ripper victim. And then the next murder victim, Annie Chapman, also residing at 35 Dorset Street. And so I said, okay, well, imagine you're Pearly Paul, and now, you know, what, six women? Or I think we're up to six women either murdered or nearly murdered in less than a year. And you know them all. You live with them. And then it goes on from there, because she also knew Mary Kelly, the final Ripper victim, and possibly, probably was at least acquaintance with all of them. Now, do I argue that Pearly Paul was the Ripper? Absolutely not. I do not believe for a moment that she was. I have no evidence that she could do any more than cut a loaf of bread. I know she was also unhealthy. Did she possibly know who the Ripper was or have an idea? Yeah, I think quite possibly so. And that's the stuff I'm exploring in my book. It's not just another one of those, ooh, look, I picked a name out of a hat and I'm going to write a book and make some money. It's a pure research piece is what my book is. And because I couldn't identify one guy with a knife in his hand as being the most likely person associated with, I don't end the book with that big reveal of here's the name of Jack the Ripper. Frankly, those books, I think they had their day in the 80s and early 90s. And, you know, the serious students of the case, we kind of scoff at them now. There are exceptions. There are suspect books like Rob House's book on Aaron Kosminski, which are afforded a lot of respect. There's also a recent thing of looking at books coming out that look at suspects from the perspective of here's why this man was not Jack the Ripper. And that's important, too. I mean, I think that's really important. In my research over the years, I've looked at all the suspects and pretty much eliminated almost all of them in my mind. But there are a few that I still say, okay, I can't eliminate this guy so that he has to stay in frame. And one of the things we all must remember, too, is Jack the Ripper may not have been one man. He may have been two men working together, may have been two or even three men murdering separately and unrelated, but who are and were believed to have been the same person. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Sure.
So, like, imagine at the time a suspect was brought forth to the police, but he had an alibi for one of the murders, and so they discounted him. Well, let's just say that that murder happened to not be an actual Ripper crime. It was a copycat that was similar, and so by providing an alibi for that one, he got off the hook for all of them, but he may have been responsible for one or more of the other murders. I don't necessarily personally believe that. I think that the five canonical Ripper victims were, in fact, killed by the same man or men. And I also think that the early murderers are related. I think that Emily Horsnell, Emma Smith, Martha Tabram, and then the five canonical crimes are all related, possibly even some of the later murders, because the evidence just really suggests that that's the case. And that's, again, that's kind of what I discuss in my book and in upcoming books. I will probably go into that in more detail as it relates to the actual Ripper murders.
Okay, well, let's go back to Emma Smith, because you do start with Emma Smith, and you talk about the unusual case again. Really what this is this, instead of uncovering this mystery and saying without a doubt, here's the solution, there is a lot of mysteries in this book, so a lot of questions are raised in this and not necessarily can be answered. But with Emma Smith, you talk about how the police are notified a couple days after she is killed, and you talk about the decorum at the time for a medical doctor when he would be testifying in public. So tell us about the description of the murder, Emma Smith, and how, possibly in history, how you have unraveled how they might not have described the murder exactly the way it really did happen. Tell us about that.
Well, as far as the decorum of the doctors, an inquest in 1888, in that time, first of all, the coroner was not a medical doctor. That was an elected position. Anyone could run for the position of coroner. Oftentimes, lawyers would win post. And so the coroners were never the doctors in question. But they would hold the inquest, the primary purpose of which was to determine the cause of death and to record certain information that could be referred back to later to kind of just correlate that information. And so in the case of Emma Smith, who was a middle-aged alcoholic prostitute, it was bank holiday night, which also for our American listeners, a bank holiday, which is the title of the book. What that means is like, think of a holiday when the banks are closed. Martin Luther King Day, President's Day, Christmas, those are bank holidays, and that's the term used in England. So, but anyways, she was walking around. It was just Easter, right at Easter time. On a bank holiday, all the soldiers would get their pay and the sailors, and they would be on leave, and they would hit the East End pubs looking for beer and women. And so this was a time to make some money. So that's what she was out doing, apparently, quite a ways from home. She had walked quite a distance from home on a rainy, cold night. She was a couple miles from home, supposedly. And at some point, she was set up on and attacked. Now, the story she told to her lodging house mates and to the doctor who tended to her was that she was set upon by two or three men who she didn't recognize, one of whom was roughly 19 years of age. They chased her. They abused her. They beat her. And then she walked home. What we know is that she was in a bad state. She was hit across the head so bad it split one of her ears, almost cutting half of the ear off. She had other injuries to her head. More importantly, a blunt instrument of some sort had been inserted inside of her and ruptured the sac surrounding her internal organs, as well as the area of flesh. Well, I don't want to get too much into that. It's pretty gross. But she was damaged pretty badly, right. Bled profusely. She took her shawl off and put it between her legs to catch the blood. And she had to be talked into going to the hospital. Back then, you know, that was just a sheer terror. We don't like going to the doctor today. Imagine back then, you know, when three people going to the hospital, one might come out alive. So she goes to the hospital. They check her in. Within 24 hours, she was dead of peritonitis, which had set in. An infection had set into her internal organs and killed her. But she had told this story to the doctor. Now, the question is, was it true? Because she was a prostitute, but she did, first of all, when she went to the hospital, she had no idea her injuries were fatal. So would she lie to protect the person who really inflicted these injuries? Yes. Women did that all the time. Would she lie to not have to admit she was a prostitute? Sure. Because the doctor did question her. Yeah, are you sure you weren't soliciting? Did you solicit this person? Oh, no, I wasn't soliciting. Well, okay. And the thing is, she said this happened at 1:30 a.m., but she didn't get to her home until hours later. So what I believe happened is she was attacked and set upon, not necessarily by three people, though. She was rendered unconscious, left for dead. I believe that whoever attacked her left her for dead, but she came awake and stumbled home. And then was taken to the hospital where she died the next day. Where she claimed she had pointed out on the way to the hospital, she pointed out to her friends, that's where I was attacked. Well, the police never found any blood there when they learned about it. The hospital authorities also did not report this to the police, nor did any of her friends. No one reported this to the police. The police did not find out about this until they received the summons from the coroner to appear at the inquest. And they were like, at the inquest for what? And they're like, well, this woman was murdered. And so the police were very frustrated. When they talked to the constables in the area, the constables all said, oh, I didn't see nothing. Well, they should have. They should have seen this bloody woman walking around from wherever she was attacked to her home, and then the half mile from her lodging house to the hospital. There were constables everywhere, but none of them claimed to have seen her. I don't think their inspector believed that. But because there were no witnesses, no one was willing to talk. They never got anywhere in the investigation, and no one was ever arrested for it. And then you skip forward to August, and you have the next bank holiday, and you have your next murder, and that's Martha Tabram. And this time, the killer or killers, absolutely, I mean, no doubt, whoever attacked Emma Smith, whoever it was, had to have, after the fact, realized how lucky they were to find out that the woman they left for dead was actually alive and had spoken to numerous people, and yet they were still not captured. So I think when that person took their next victim, they wanted to make absolutely certain before they left that that woman was, that this could not happen again. And in Martha's case, they did that. They stabbed her 39 times. One of those wounds with a very long blade right through her heart. So she wasn't going to talk to anyone. But I'll go ahead and stop because you're asking about Emma Smith. So did I answer that question, or should I, or is there something I didn't cover?
Well,
there?
What I wanted to bring up is an important figure in here too, or somewhat important figure, is Dr. Haslip.
Yeah.
And he's a surgeon that looks at Emma Smith, and then he looks at Martha Tabram as well, and then there's a conclusion I thought was very, very interesting, is the walking stick. So first they have you have a description of a blunt instrument. So tell us about the blunt instrument, Dr. Haslip's conclusions, and if he makes any connections between the two murders. Tell us about him and his conclusions and what he finds.
Dr. Haslip, first of all, one thing is he had nothing to do with Tabram, Martha Tabram. Whether or not he saw her, I don't know, but he wasn't the doctor that tended to her. That was a doctor, Colleen. But Dr. Haslip happened to be the surgeon in charge at the London Hospital, which what was remarkable to me is that he was 22 years old. And he was the surgeon in charge at that time that Emma Smith was brought in at the London Hospital, 22 years old. So times have changed. You would not see that today. So, but he, you know, he looked, first of all, again, when Emma Smith came in, he probably didn't assume her injuries were fatal. He only knew what he could see from the outside, and her injuries were all internal. Her potentially fatal ones were internal. She was lucid. She was conscious. She was probably not very forthcoming with what had happened to her down there. And he discovered that during the autopsy that he performed. But now when he took the stand at the inquest, he did not, nor should he have been expected, to detail every injury that was inflicted upon her, because the purpose was to determine how she died. And he had to discuss that, the injuries that were inflicted on her, through her vagina and possibly through into her anus as well, because the skin that separated the two was completely was ripped, or was torn, not ripped. It was through just sheer blunt force. Whoever inflicted those injuries on Emma Smith did it with just great force and presumably with a lot of anger. They really wanted to hurt this woman. And but Dr. Haslip, you know, that's pretty much the extent of it, other than he appeared in the press following the murder of Pauline Nichols, stating that he did believe the murders were related. He didn't say why, but he believed they were related.
Now, another character is Inspector Edmund Reed, and you also have Chief Inspector John West, and you just alluded to it. You thought that Edmund Reed found some of this story kind of incredible.
Well, what we know for a fact, because Edmund Reed was an extremely well-respected inspector. I get the impression that he kind of did his own thing. He wasn't strictly by the book, and that probably rubbed some of his superiors the wrong way, and then others loved him for it. He got results, though. But in the Ripper case, obviously he didn't. The Ripper was never caught, but in numerous interviews he gave years later, like right upon his retirement, because only at retirement could he openly talk to the public about these cases. So once he retired, he spoke about them, and he was clear on the point that he believed Ripper was, or that one man was responsible for like 11 murders, or no, I think he attributed 9 murders to one man. And I don't know that I agree with him on all those, and I don't agree with all of his conclusions and all of that. But what seems clear to me is that he did not believe the story that Emma Smith was killed by three men. And that's the story that Emma Smith allegedly told herself to the doctor and to her friends. He did not believe that. He believed that a single man, who we know as Jack the Ripper, killed Emma Smith. And I'm intrigued by that. Why would he throw out this statement from Emma Smith? What did he know? What did he learn? But it's not just what he knew about the people at the time, or I mean about these specific people and the specific incidents. It's what he knew about the East End of London, how it operated, how the lodging houses operated, and how people would lie to authorities. So my point being that here's the inspector in charge of the case, and he doesn't buy Emma Smith's story, so why should I? And so I look at it from that perspective. I don't know that the story she told was false, but I have to consider that it may have been because Inspector Reed did. Does that make sense?
Yes. We're going to just use this as a pause to stop and talk about the sponsor of this episode, which is Squarespace. And I don't know if you saw the recent Super Bowl and the really cool commercial for Squarespace with the dude, a.k.a. Jeff Bridges, but he has partnered with Squarespace to bring his unique project to life. Jeff and his friends have created an album of soothing and relaxing sounds, guided meditations, and stories designed to lull you to sleep. Visit Squarespace to see Jeff Bridges' amazing website, dreamingwithjeff.com. Now, with Squarespace, you can create a unique, one-of-a-kind website. Squarespace features an elegant interface and beautiful templates with dedicated 24/7 customer support. Every website comes with a free online store and a free domain name with your first annual plan. Your website will scale to look great on any device, and with cover pages, you have a gorgeous one-page online presence in minutes. Now, whether you want to create a fantastic website or blog, an e-commerce store, portfolio, or all of the above, you can express your ideas powered by an elegant yet intuitive platform. Start a free trial today, no credit card required. And when you sign up at squarespace.com, use the offer code TRUEMURDER for a 10% discount off your first purchase. I want to thank Squarespace very much for the support of this episode of True Murder. Squarespace, build it beautiful. So when we last left off, Tom, we were talking about Edmund Reed. So tell us a little bit about how, a little bit more about the your investigation into some of the people that worked at these lodging houses. It's very interesting how you, again, you don't really come up to conclusions, but the conduct of some of these, in these two stories, the Emma Smith and the Martha Tavern, you do point out these inconsistencies with witnesses that came forward. So tell us a little bit more about what you allude to, basically, is that talking about the bouncers and the muscle that were at these lodging houses and the people that were managers and some of the motivation for people to look the other way if they were to know somebody that were assaulting these women. Tell us a little bit more about that investigation into the likelihood that that these lodging houses and the men at the center of them might have something to do with these murders.
Well, you know, you have to put yourself in the place of a middle-aged prostitute, because that's who these victims were, for the most part, were middle-aged prostitutes in the East End of London. These were the most desperate of the desperate. Their options for anything, money-making, were extremely limited. But I also want to say that, you know, the idea that they were full-time prostitutes isn't necessarily true. I think these women would, there were a lot of young, attractive women prostituting themselves in the East End. They could charge more money. They would steal away the custom. And so these middle-aged women would were also thieves and engaged in other criminal activities as well to make money and you know, to keep their room and all of this. But as the landlords, you held the power, not just because you owned the places they got food. You owned the places they drank, and you owned the places they slept. And through my research, I identified a small group of men, most of them Irish or of Irish descent, who were either great friends or interrelated by marriage. And, I mean, we're talking a real small group here of men, and all the victims across the board, all of them, every one of them, came from the lodging houses owned by these men. Many of them lived in various lodging houses. Mary Kelly, I believe, lived in the same lodging houses that Emma Smith, Emily Horsnell, Martha Tabram, all of them stayed in at one point. Mary Kelly was living there as well. So I thought, what a curious connection, this little group of men who also happened to be police informants. So they had a relationship with the police. They would, and some of the police were on, the police were on their payroll, basically. And again, if you were a constable in that area, that might have been, in some cases, it was just out of sheer necessity. Because then as now, the police in London didn't carry guns. They didn't carry, you know, weapons. They had a truncheon at the time. Their life was made hell. It's not like today where you see a cop and, we wouldn't think of walking up to a cop and spitting on him or punching him or hitting him or chasing him down a street. But that's what he dealt with on a nightly basis in the East End of London. And it was made all the worse if you weren't willing to work with the guys who controlled all the criminals in the East End, that being the landlords. If you did work with them, they worked with you. And they would give you tips, help you make arrests off the books, of course. You could also make money from them through the gambling. You know, if you turned a blind eye to an illegal boxing match or some illegal gambling, hey, you know, you got a little piece on the back end. So all of that was going on. And so if you're a 45-year-old woman, alcoholic, dependent upon, you know, and here's the guy who runs the police in your neighborhood, then that man is close to God to you. So you're going to do whatever he says and however he says it. And so that's the kind of power they had. So in the case of Emma Smith, one of the things that rubbed me wrong was the idea of how she came back to the lodging house. And the deputy keeper, whose name was Mary Russell, she was basically the on-site manager of the house. Not the owner, but the on-site manager. And she says, oh, well, you know, we talked to Emma Enda going to the hospital, and then we escorted her to the hospital. So I'm thinking, wait a minute. So this woman leaves the lodging house she's in charge of to walk this woman to the hospital. That doesn't sound right to me. She can't do that. She's not allowed to do that and keep her job. What must have happened is the owner, Daniel Smith, had to have been, who lived nearby, would have been summoned to come over, look at Emma, and agree that Emma should go to the hospital, and then at that point would have told Emma, here's what you tell the doctor. And that's when the story would have been concocted as to what actually happened to Emma. And then Emma went to the hospital and told the doctor what she was told to tell him. Again, not knowing her injuries were fatal or anything. She was going to heal, be out in a few days, and would have to return back to her normal life. In truth, Emma may have very well known exactly who attacked her, known his identity, but she couldn't say that because she'd have to deal with this person in a few days when she got out and came back. That's just the reality of the times and the place they lived in. But Daniel's name was kept out of it. Again, the same thing had just happened November with Emily Horsnell in the lodging house next door, owned by Daniel Smith's friend, John Satchel, a young woman, beat to death, died of peritonitis. Remarkably, no autopsy was performed. The coroners asked the cops, are you planning to investigate this? They're like, not really, we don't have a clue. And they're like, okay, well, if you're not going to investigate, then I'm not going to bother with the expense of having an autopsy performed. And it's shocking, but that's what happened. And as a result, her murder did not go down as a murder. It was given a verdict of open. And that's the only reason why she's not considered the first of the Whitechapel murders, is because officially she wasn't murdered. But realistically, the doctor stated this woman was beat to death. She was kicked, beaten. Her belly was extended. Her organs ruptured. And she was allowed to languish for days in the lodging house, not being taken to a doctor, never was taken to a doctor. And then the only one who would speak up to tell her story was John Satchel. None of the lodgers, who would have been the people she actually spoke with, came forth and were because John wouldn't allow it. He was the one who appeared at the inquest. He was the one who said, oh, well, she said that she was beaten up by some strangers a few nights ago. And that was the end of it. And the police are like, we're not touching it. And then this exact same thing happened with Emma. And so I'm like, okay, something's going on here. You know, what is this? What's going on here? I don't want to say cover up. I mean, since the JFK thing, words like conspiracy and cover up have taken on a real fringe meaning. But, realistically, what we're talking about here is more like a proto-mafia. That's what the lodging house keepers were. And that's a fact. You know, they were a group of guys kind of loosely organized. They ran the show. They ran illegal gambling. I'm not saying they went around putting out hits on people. I don't think these were certainly not mafia murders, these women who were butchered in the streets. But that doesn't mean that they weren't protecting somebody or protecting their own interests somehow by shielding the identity of the murder from police for whatever reasons. There is a lot of evidence that suggests something like that was going on.
Well, that's going to be we're going to talk about Martha Tabram and a little bit more, you know, elaborate more on Polly Pohl's story and the extent of that, the belief in that story with Inspector Reed, you know, organizing an incredible lineup. So, but what I wanted to say was one of the more striking parts of your book, again, just while I have this thought in my mind, is that, you know, we're in 2015 and we think we understand the decay that has happened in our cities and in our countries, I guess, and we see all the news, obviously, and sort of the lots of people kind of reveling in sort of the gore, I guess, and sort of graphic detail and sort of misery of others, I would say. But, you know, in 1888, it wasn't that much different. It looked like marauding gangs and prostitutes with people really just, you know, a widow that was had an alcohol problem, ends up being on the street, like you say, the vermin, the sheets weren't washed for 3 months, they have a bouncer at a lodging house, and if they didn't have a lodging house, they would have slept rough, which means outside, again, vulnerable to all these elements, and alcohol was a drug of choice, but certainly people weren't real sedate. Drinking this alcohol had all the problems inherent of today's society. I thought that was amazing that things, as much as they change, don't change that much.
Well, it was much worse then than it is now, and it was much worse 100 years before that than it was in 1888. And that is something. When you study the past and you isolate a certain period of time, like I've done and other ripperologists have done, because we tend to focus on the late Victorian period and particularly London. And a lot of funny things occur to you because, you know, part of this comes, you know, we read hundreds and hundreds of newspapers from that time. And you're reading just about daily life, you know, not just about these murders, but just life in general, the good stuff, the bad stuff. And, you know, it's funny because people would be in the newspaper talking about, oh, kids these days, they don't have the respect that we had in our day and blah, blah, blah. And all the and kids these days reading their penny dreadfuls and blah, blah, blah. And it's the exact same stuff that you know, I find myself saying now, you know, kids these days. And that adults were saying when we were kids. And this goes back to the beginning of time. So it's actually a self-perpetuating myth that there was something better about your generation than about the current generation. That is a self-perpetuating myth. In reality, if you want to talk, if I were a woman, I would much rather be alive today than back in 1888 when the newspapers, you should read them, they were absolutely littered with nothing but domestic murder of the most brutal kinds, far in excess of what we see today. I mean, a lot of people don't realize, they're familiar with the term the rule of thumb. You always hear people say, well, the rule of thumb is blah, blah, blah. The rule of thumb is actually a law that here in America that was in effect up well into the 1950s that stated a man could beat his wife, but he had to use a switch that was no larger than his thumb. Then it became abuse. But if it was the size of his thumb or less, it was not abuse, and that was the rule of thumb. You know, we live in a society today, you know, that we wear wife beater t-shirts, and that's how okay it is in our minds still. Well, 100 years ago, that was the norm. Yeah, a woman couldn't own land. She couldn't divorce her husband unless she proved numerous things. You know, he had to be cheating on her and physically abusing her and this and that. Whereas a man could divorce his wife if he just kind of felt like it. That's, you know. So are we better today than back then? Absolutely. In virtually almost every way you can think of, not to mention dentistry.
Dentistry.
Yeah.
Let's get back to Martha Tabram and Curly Paul and what she said about the soldiers and the investigation that ensues into whether they could actually locate these soldiers and any witnesses that knew anything about Martha Tabram that night.
Well, Curly Paul emerged as the most important witness in the Tabram case. Actually, a few women came forth. They were shown a photo of Martha and identified her from that photo. A couple women looked at it and thought she was one person, but they were mistaken. And then Curly Paul came forth and said, "That's Emma. Her name is Emma. She lives with me at 35 or at 19 George Street." And then another woman came forth and said, "Well, that's Martha Tabram. She used to live with me before she moved out." And they came to realize that Emma and Martha were the same person. The Martha had just taken the name Emma when she moved into 19 George Street, which is also fascinating considering the woman murdered prior was named Emma. But Curly Paul said, yeah, on the night of her murder, she and I were hitting the pubs, and there were these two young soldiers, a private and a corporal, who escorted us around from pub to pub drinking. And just on the surface, this story is hard to believe because these, you know, were very unattractive, dirty East End women, and these young soldiers with their paychecks would have presumably gone for a younger, more attractive set. And there were women like that all over the place. And even if they just wanted a quickie, that's not what Curly Paul tells us happened. She tells us that they go around spending all their money in the bars, drinking and getting them drunk, and then go to their dark corners to have sex and presumably pay for that as well. But then, so she tells them this, and so naturally the soldiers become prime suspects. They have to be found. They have to be identified. These were the last men known to be seen with Martha Tabram. So Inspector Reed has identity parades at the local barracks at the Tower of London. Curly Paul is brought in. She goes into the first one, and she's like, nah. And she's acting like she's all a hot shot and a superstar, and she's just like, nah, they're not here. They're not here. Then she goes, oh, I remembered something else. They had white bands on their caps. And he's like, oh, well, that's a totally different group of guardsmen. So he has to call Pimlico and have their soldiers on the ready and go down there for a viewing of them, and she just pretty much picks out the first two men she sees. That's them. And of course, you know, and these men must have been sweating profusely, but their alibis checked out. They couldn't have been the soldiers. And Inspector Reed, none of the cops believed her anymore. She then disappears. Oh, in between these two identity parades, she disappears off the map. She goes into hiding, saying, I'm going to go kill myself. But they track her down and kind of force her against her will to keep going to these identity parades. And so something changed there for her. Who was she hiding from? What was she hiding from? Why was she thinking of killing herself? Was she anxious to cooperate with the police one minute and then not the next? And she never answered. She also wouldn't do an interview with the press. There's not a single interview with her in the press. And keep in mind, they would have paid her a lot of money to do that. You know, she could have had a bidding war from the various newspapers, and she didn't. I always thought that was interesting. She doesn't, because some people have argued, well, she lied to get publicity. She was trying to get her name in the press. I'm like, well, then why is she the only person associated with this case who was not interviewed, who refused interviews, who the press couldn't track down? They tried to, but she would refuse to speak to them. So no, none of this was for attention. She had something else motivating her to lie to the police, to throw them off the track, to make them think some soldier killed Martha. Well, if it wasn't a soldier, then who was it? You know, and that's, again, what led me back to the lodging. I'm like, who holds this kind of sway over this woman? Well, the only person I could think of was her lodging housekeeper, who she was close to, and his... And then when she moves from his house to another house, it's one of his friend's houses. And It's, you know, in a spitting distance of where Mary Kelly would later be murdered. You know, Pearlie Paul also happened to know Annie Chapman. One of Pearlie Paul's best friends beat up Annie Chapman a day or two before her murder. So there's all these little connections, these threads running through it that I wish I had more answers than I did. But in my book, I construct various scenarios. All of them, there's a lot of speculation in there, but it's all based on contemporary documentation, based on facts. It's based on the press reports and the police reports. I use a lot of both of those to build from, as well as just some kind of logical speculation where it's needed. But I hope that I try to make an effort so that the reader knows when I'm giving them the facts as we know them and when I'm giving them speculation, so they can dispose of that if they choose to.
Now, we talked, we didn't talk about this, but this, I think this is important, because you do talk about that there is some aspects of the Martha Tavram case that have proved the most polarizing among ripperologists. Mm-hmm. And so let's get to there are wounds to her neck, heart, and sex organs. And
right.
So then tell us about the description of the injuries, but also why this is most polarizing among ripperologists, this Martha Tavram case.
Well, Martha it's the, is she or isn't she? That's the question. Is she a ripper victim or is she not? And it's like you could argue it either way, because, see, her throat was not slit. Jack the Ripper got his name because he kept slicing women's throats. Martha
right.
Tavram was stabbed. Even her throat was stabbed. She was not. Her throat was not cut. And so it's almost, some people have described her murder as a frenzy killing because of the 39 stabs and all of this. Well, in my research, I looked a little closer at all the same material, and I came away with a different idea of her murder. Surprisingly, she was almost nude when she was found. Her legs were thrust up in the same way Polly Nichols were. Her skirts were thrown up, same as Polly Nichols. Her cloak was torn open, and apparently Tavram did not have a shirt on underneath, and her breasts were exposed. So she must have looked like a rape victim when she was found. Like the later victim, she had not been raped in the classical sense, but there was a great deal of blood between her legs, and I thought, well, that's interesting, considering all the stab wounds are really on the upper part of her body. Why was there so much blood between her legs? And so I studied everything a little closer and came away with the conclusion that, like Emma Smith, she had been raped with an inanimate object, this time a sharp object, probably the same long-bladed weapon that was that inflicted the wound to her heart. And therefore, in my mind, it clicked. You know, a question that people really were never asking. People were always asking, was Martha Tavram a Ripper victim? In other words, was she killed by the same person who killed Polly Nichols? A question I had was she killed by the same person who killed Emma Smith? I wanted to go, answer that backwards. And to me, that pretty much proved conclusively that Emma Smith and Martha Tavram were murdered by the same people or person. In very similar fashions, although obviously Emma Smith was not stabbed or cut or anything like that we know of. Martha Tavram most certainly was. And the reason I believe is because Emma Smith, again, survived her injuries, as did Emily Horsnell before her. So this person, after the Emma Smith, was terrified of being identified, so made sure that from that point forward his victims did not survive his attack. And that's why we see those injuries are Martha Tavram in such a way. And in an upcoming book, I'm going to talk about Polly Nichols from a perspective no one else has looked at her before, with some information that really hasn't been considered. But I do believe that Tavram and Nichols, looking at the crime scene evidence, the medical evidence in a new way, their murders are actually more similar than we currently believe. And they were, in fact, killed by the same person. But back to Tavram and Smith, their murders occurred mere yards from one another. The locations were only yards apart. These are two women who lived, although they never met, their lodging houses were next door to each other. I say they never met because Emma Smith had died long before Martha Tabram moved into that lodging house. She'd only lived there a few weeks before her murder, but the lodging houses were next door to each other. And they were both raped with inanimate objects and died from this attack. So then we have a question to ask ourselves. We have somebody who has killed Emily Horsnell, Emma Smith, Martha Tabram. And then Martha Tabram's inquest is held 1 week. The next weekend following the ending of her inquest, Polly Nichols is murdered. So then the question is, did the serial killer who killed these first three women just, you know, disappear off the face of the earth in time for a new serial killer to emerge and start killing the same class of women in the same area, but in a somewhat in a more mature, refined method? Or are all these murders related? Either the same person is committing them all, or it's two different people, but operating under the same influence. Those are the questions that I'm asking myself to this day, and that I ask in pretty much anything I'm writing.
Tell us just a little bit about the role of the Inspector Aberline from Scotland Yard, and just tell us a little bit about his role and his conclusions afterwards.
Inspector Aberline? Well, I don't really talk about him at all in the book. I'm probably not an authority on that per se, but he is certainly the most famous of the investigators, having been personified by the likes of Michael Caine and the 1988 television miniseries Jack the Ripper, and then Johnny Depp in 2001's From Hell, and actually even more recently in the film The Wolfman Hugo Weaving portrayed him.
Right.
And just set the record straight, contrary to the filmic depictions of him, he was not an alcoholic, he was not an absinthe addict, and he apparently was not a psychic, but that's how he's portrayed in film. But Inspector Aberline, his beat for many, many, many years was Whitechapel, the East End. And he was a very, very capable investigator. He rose up the ranks, and then Scotland Yard snagged him up and moved him into Scotland Yard. In fact, it was Inspector Reed was kind of moving up behind him, taking his old spots. So when the Ripper case happened, in fact, it was following Martha Tabram and before Polly Nichols, Scotland Yard got involved and said, we need our Whitechapel man, Aberline, to go back there and help out on this. And so he was one of many inspectors and investigators involved in these, but I don't think of him as being the man in charge as he's portrayed in Hollywood. Certainly he was one of the men in charge. But his conclusions that came to him long after his retirement. He believed a fellow by the name of Severin Klosowski, a.k.a. George Chapman, was Jack the Ripper. And this man was a barber. He was a wife murderer. He would marry women, poison them, take their money. Okay, that's what this guy did. And he wasn't Jack the Ripper. So Aberline was mistaken on that point. Chapman's not that great of a suspect. Other than, you know, I have to say this man was a murderer, so he possessed the instincts to kill. And he did live in the East End at the time, very close to these murders. But there's nothing to suggest that he went out with a knife and killed anyone. He would poison women. A totally different method of dispatch. So, but that was Aberline's thoughts after retirement, was that he was the murderer. What's more interesting is Aberline's comments on other suspects and why he did, you know, like Aaron Kosminski, who's been in the news the last year because of the shawl and all that. He didn't think Aaron Kosminski was the Ripper. He didn't think the drowned, a.k.a. doctor, or, you know, quote-unquote doctor, Montague John Drewitt, was the Ripper. He didn't obviously believe in any of those theories for one reason or another. But he did believe that George Chapman was the most likely person to have been the Ripper, and I would disagree with that, but I respect his thoughts.
Now, one of the other really fascinating parts of your book is you talk about and dissect the whole Leather Apron story. So tell us about Leather Apron, John Pizer, and who accused him, and tell us the whole story that you outlined.
Well, Leather Apron Before the name Jack the Ripper came about, in a letter written to a news agency, the press needed something to call this guy who was running around killing women. And the name Leather Apron took hold because some of the women in the neighborhood, particularly the women who lived at 18 Thrall Street, which was Polly Nichols' final address, told of a strange cobbler, a shoemaker who would wander around being mean or he's just kind of crazy, and they'd make fun of him and call him Leather Apron because he wore a leather apron. And they told the police about this, and they told the press about this. Well, then the press took that and kind of exaggerated a bit and created this character with these menacing eyes and these crazy whiskers and all of this and sold a lot of copy with that character. And so the police were like, okay, well, who is this Leather Apron? We clearly need to talk to him. And, I think Leather Apron was probably more than one person. None of whom were the killer. But this fellow by the name of John Pizer was pointed out on the street as being Leather Apron. And the cops just talked to him for a minute and let him go. No one thought anything of it until Sergeant William Thick decided, oh, yeah, I've known Pizer for 18 years. And whenever anyone speaks of Leather Apron, they're talking about him. We got to hunt him down. And that became a big thing. And he was eventually arrested at his home and taken into police custody. And the press were always in the footsteps of the police. I mean, they would literally follow the police. And if the police knocked on a door and spoke to someone, as soon as the cop left, the pressman would be there knocking on the door saying, what did you just talk about? And so... And it was, there were 100 times more newspapers than today. London might have, 2 or 3 major newspapers. In 1888, it had over 120. And that we're talking one city. So, and American newspapers had London correspondents. So anyways, Pizer was arrested as Leather Apron. And the press tried to find evidence that this guy was Leather Apron. What they found was that no one in the neighborhood, no one who knew him, ever knew him by that name. And he steadfastly denied being Leather Apron. But this, with his reputation, he was ran through the mud in the press as being Leather Apron, and Sergeant Thick was making all these statements about him being Leather Apron. And what I talk about in my book, it appears, in my opinion, Thick lied. It's pretty clear he lied. Pizer was not known as Leather Apron. Those two did know each other personally for 18 years. They lived in roughly the same area and knew each other. There was an identity parade where a man stepped forward and picked Pizer out of a group of men and said, yeah, I saw him attacking Annie Chapman. Well, it turned out this man was lying. And in my opinion, Thick put him up to it. He said, go pick out Pizer and accuse him of basically murdering Annie Chapman. And it backfired. It didn't work. So eventually a deal was struck where Pizer would appear at the inquest into Annie Chapman's murder and be allowed to publicly clear him of any wrongdoing in the murder, but in return he had to admit to being Leather Apron because he was already talking about suing everybody. And the police couldn't let that get out. So they struck a deal. If you just say you're known as Leather Apron, and by doing that he lets the police off the hook, then you'll be allowed to clear your name. There'll be no more suspicion against you because mobs were forming outside his door trying to kill him.
Right.
That's how unpopular he was. So that's the story. But I thought, well, why would this police sergeant with an otherwise pretty good reputation, why would he do this? It doesn't make any sense. And then I started researching him, and I'm like, oh, well, look at that. 6 years before, there he is giving good character references for John Satchel, Pearly Paul's landlord, and John McCarthy, Mary Kelly's landlord, and the Lords of Spitalfields. And then I did more research, and he had a reputation of fitting people up. And I'm not making this stuff up. I've gotten a lot of heat from some ripperologists because they just think the police can do no wrong. And then on the other hand, you have people who say, oh, the police were all idiots. And I don't believe in any of those. The police overall back then were very good, but there's going to be bad apples in every bunch. And then there's going to be cops who usually are good, but then, you know, they also step out and do crazy things for extra money. And it appears that's what Sergeant William Thicke was. So then the question is, was he framing Pizer? Why was he framing Pizer? Who was he trying to protect? Was someone paying him to do this? What was the motivation? I do not believe that Sergeant William Thicke was a murderer or anything, although he does hold the dubious distinction of being the only member of the police force at the time to be accused by a member of the public of being Jack the Ripper. A lawyer was writing letters saying, I think Sergeant William Thicke is Jack the Ripper. But there's nothing, I don't believe that for a second, but did Thicke maybe have an idea of who the Ripper was and decided it was in his best interest to keep that information to himself and possibly frame an innocent person? That's possible. That's possible. But, you know, there's other possibilities as well.
And he was known as Upright, and you explain what that meant.
Johnny Upright was his name, and in the street slang, if there was an urban dictionary published in 1888, which in fact there was, but it was published in the 1500s, but it talked about a man who was known as an upright was someone who would squeal, or someone who would take money to turn a blind eye, who would use prostitutes, who would, you know, just, it's like a play on words. Upright, you think it to mean an upright citizen, you know, upstanding citizen, high morals. Well, in slang, you took a word and then whatever its opposite was is what its actual meaning was. So criminals called him Johnny Upright because he was a crooked cop, in other words. Now, the flip side to that, of course, the police spin on it was, oh, he was Johnny Upright because he was such an upstanding cop. But that doesn't appear to be the case. He was given the name by a criminal who was getting convicted on his evidence. So clearly that person gave him that name because he was accusing Thicke of fitting him up on fake evidence to get him convicted. If there was no truth to that, I don't think the name would have stuck, but it did, and that became his street nickname, is Johnny Upright.
Part of this book too is, I know we're jumping around just a little bit, but you state this other, again, so many coincidences here that you put together for the reader to just ponder and really question yourself, because you don't have all the answers, but you still, you know, you bring all the information to get a conclusion drawn. Tell us about the Flower and Dean address connection between Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, Pearly Paul, Mary Kelly. Tell us, describe this vicinity of how short a distance it is between all of these and the commonality between these addresses.
Well, one thing, you know, that I talk about in the book and is talked about in other Ripper books is the fact that all the Ripper murders occurred inside of 1 square mile. That's why, you know, there are Ripper walking tours in London where you can sign up and a tour guide will take you around to not all of, but a number of the murder sites in a relatively short period of time, because they're all within walking distance of each other. And you can't really name any other serial killers out there. You couldn't do a Ted Bundy walking tour. You know what I mean? Because he's over numerous states. But you can with the Ripper, and I find that very curious in itself. Flower and Dean Street, Elizabeth Stride and Catherine Eddowes are two of the Ripper victims killed on the same night, what's known as the double event, September 30th of 1888. They were killed in different areas. Catherine Eddowes was killed in Mitre Square area in the city of London, and Elizabeth Stride was killed on Berner Street. They were killed, it's a 10-minute, their murder sites were 10 minutes walk apart, and they were murdered 45 minutes one from the other. What's interesting is these two women, aside from being approximately the same age, also happened to have lived on the same street, Flower and Dean Street, for 6 or 7 years. I don't know that they knew each other, that they were friends. There's no question they had to have known each other by sight, at least, and were probably acquainted just by virtue of the fact, again, if we can't judge anything by how it is today. We all think, well, gosh, Tom, I've lived in my house for 5 years, and I couldn't tell you the names of the people 2 doors down from me. But I can guarantee you, if you saw him at the store, you'd probably recognize him, wouldn't you? But this is a different time. These people didn't sit in their cozy air-conditioned homes watching TV all day. They were, when they weren't sleeping or cooking, they were out in front of their lodging houses. They were in the streets. They were in the pub on that street. They were in the little corner grocery stores eating and sitting outside and talking with one another. That being the bathhouses, going to the bathhouses. Catherine Eddowes and Elizabeth Stride had to have known each other. They probably worked, again, they would make both supposedly make extra money by cleaning. Well, they would have been cleaning in the same buildings. So it's just another interesting connection. Because these days, one of the popular things is to go, ooh, was Elizabeth Stride a Ripper victim or was she not? People think they're hip if they can take a Ripper victim and argue that she wasn't a Ripper victim, even though they have to use a lot of false information to do that. And some very reputable authors do that. Donald Rumbelow, and in the most recent edition of his book, gets all the facts wrong in his attempt to try and argue that Elizabeth Stride was not a Ripper victim. And numerous authors before him have done that, and it's, again, self-perpetuating. One author makes a mistake, and it gets repeated. You know, that's why each author has to kind of do their own research. I've made, you know, mistakes, I'm sure, in my book that I'll have to correct in a future edition if someone else doesn't correct it first. But, you know, you got to at least make the effort to not make those kind of mistakes. But, yes, Elizabeth Stride most probably was killed by the same person who killed Catherine Eddowes. And that person was probably the same person who killed Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman, and Mary Kelly. But, of course, nobody can say that for 100% certainty. But we're dealing with probabilities. And when you're looking at a 126-year-old cold case, you know, that's all you have are possibilities and probabilities. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Let me ask this question, because this, I'm a curious fellow, and after reading this book, you, again, just like we had mentioned, the Flower and Dean address connection, the connection between Stride, Eddowes, Pearlie Paul, Mary Kelly, you put another interesting thing without really spelling it out, but you say Mary Kelly was butchered in her own flat, in one of the rooms, and the witness that discovered her, he immediately went to the lodging or contacted the lodging house owner.
Right.
And so you do talk about that in terms of these other murders that, again, the protocol must have been for these people to go to the lodging house owner first. You talk about that with Emma Smith. The other thing I wanted to ask was, with these tenuous connections between all of these victims, what do you say about the, again, the idea that one killer may have escalated his crimes, changed his signature? Is there any kind of good possibility that one killer, or the one killer with an accomplice, did all of these murders?
Yes, I would say it's a probability that the murders of Emily Horsnell, Emma Smith, Martha Tabram, Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Kelly were all the same person or persons. That to me is a probability. Now, when you get to the murders that followed Mary Kelly, we're into a more of a gray area. You know, although one of them, Rose Milet, who's it's interesting because she also lived at 19 George Street, and her boyfriend was a boxer who John Satchel trained and paid a lot of money to train. And I've often wondered, you know, and others have wondered too, if Jack the Ripper himself wasn't a boxer, because the reason, the way these women, I believe, were rendered unconscious, because they weren't, most of them were not strangled per se, but they were all somehow rendered unconscious in a way the doctors could not detect. And I in my book, I present the most probable, to my mind, way of doing this. It was called garroting, but not with a string or a cord, but using your own arm to to render a person unconscious, which was crucial for the Ripper, because he can't have this woman screaming out, you know, and running and getting help and then capturing him, right? So he had to quickly render her unconscious, which meant he had to be tall and strong. That's who we're looking for. And the people who would know these techniques would be boxers and criminals. So that's another clue that wasn't in the books before mine, but that's something to strongly consider, and it explains away the mystery of how some of these women were rendered unconscious but yet left no fingerprints on the neck, you know, or the telltale signs of strangulation that you usually see.
Now, just to lay a little credibility to what you're saying, you do talk about in the book that these lodging house owners also had these amateur fight clubs as well, and so part of their income was, I guess, gambling and owning and organizing these fights. And so maybe the protection of one of these fighters possibly could have been a motive for a cover-up.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I've wondered about that exact same thing, you know, because a boxer is an asset.
Sure.
A boxer is an asset. So, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, did a boxer lose his temper and beat up Emily Horsnell? And they said, well, let's just cover it up. Just, hey, you know, don't let it happen again. Well, then it happens again. And they're like, hey, you got to stop. And then it keeps happening. And then at some point it's out of control. It's a possibility. It's a possibility. But I have no proof or straightforward evidence to say that that's the case. It's just, that's just another speculation. You know what I'm saying? That's what I was hoping to find. I was hoping to find that enough avenues led to a certain individual where we could point to him and go, aha, he's extremely suspicious. But that's not the case. Instead, there's a number of individuals who are suspicious, and it could be any one of them or none of them.
Right. Now, you talked about near the beginning of the interview about, since this book has come out, the acceptance, and I guess, you know, you had a little bit of trepidation on that as well, because it is a pretty esteemed group sometimes that looks at has tackled some of this. So tell us about the response since the book has come out, and in particular anything that really surprised you or, you know, really impressed you, made you pretty satisfied with what you had done.
Well, Paul Begg, who is, you know, as far as Ripper authors go, is you know, he's like up at the top of the heap, right? He's like the Beatles. I call him the Beatles of Ripperology. And then Stuart P. Evans is the Elvis of Ripperology. Anyways, Paul Begg writes reviews for Ripperologist magazine, and my book came out in February of 2014, and he said, even though it's too early to say because it's the beginning of the year, he predicted my book might be the best Ripper book of the year, which is really saying something, considering he had his own book coming out the next month. But,
nice.
You know, that set everything off to a good pace. And then if anyone who wants to go to Amazon or Goodreads and read what people say, I've just been overwhelmed with the positive response. Of course, I've had a handful of critics, you know, who just immediately, if it's in that book and it's under my name, it's just crap. You know, you're always going to have
okay.
And it feels like the Ripperology, like any field where there's debate, is everything is contentious. But those people, you know, they keep you on your toes, too. It's good to have someone with a good head on their shoulders picking your work apart and saying, okay, here's this. Here's, it makes you look and think about things. And it also, it led to people going out. Sometimes people go out to try and prove you wrong and find new evidence. Sometimes it actually proves you right. And sometimes it does prove you wrong. The truth is what matters, though. I couldn't care less whether I'm right or wrong about anything. What I want to see happen is new stuff gets discovered and brought to light. You know what I'm saying? And that has happened. That right there, that answers your question. The best thing that's happened since this book came out is I've seen a lot of new information come out. Discussions happen. Research has taken place that wouldn't have happened had I not come out with that book. And some of that's come from my biggest critics and some from my biggest fans and then some from the people who are extremely objective and just stay right down the middle. But that's my favorite thing about it. That, and I also like the money. The money's been fun, you know. I haven't gotten rich from it, but considering I thought I was writing that, I wrote this book and I thought, I hope I just kind of break even or something. But it's like I said, it's done well, and people like Dan Sapansky are saying, get on my show, and I'm like, well. So I didn't expect, I swear to God, I had no idea anyone would want to talk to me just because of this little book. But it's won 3 awards, you know, too. It's won some,
right,
a Best History Book Award, a Best True Crime Book Award. So, very pleased.
Great. And I guess that's going to inspire you, because you already have plans. I mean, this is not, okay, I've done the definitive Jack the Ripper book, so I can retire now and just rest on my laurels. But I'm sure you've got, so you talked about Charles LeGrand, and so tell us what is in the works next.
Well, right now, as we speak, I'm actually writing fiction, which I publish under a different name. But so I'm taking a break from Ripperology.
Oh, really?
But yeah, well, not an extended break or anything, I'm sure. But you know, I've written some on my next Ripper book, which is where I want to take the Ripper murders and do what I did with Emma Smith and Martha Tabor, which was start at the beginning and research them unbiased. And I want to continue on with that because I stopped. I stopped when I got to Polly Nichols because I had to write the bank holiday murder. So starting with Nichols and moving forward, I want to keep that going on. I've already written most of a pretty large section on Polly Nichols, which I think is going to cause a lot of debate and a lot of people will love it and some will hate it. It's going to have new stuff. And then just keep going on. It's time consuming though. It's tough work. And so anyways, I want to do that book, and then I want to do Charles LeGrand. I want to do a book on him, which you could call it a suspect book. But again, my approach is going to be to respect the reader in the same way that I want to be respected when I read a book. I don't want someone telling me what the truth is and shoving it down my throat and saying, oh, here's Jack the Ripper. I'm going to say, here's a guy who people back then, some of them thought was Jack the Ripper. Let's take a closer look at him and see what, you know, and then you decide what you think. Because I'm not convinced he's Jack. I'm not convinced anybody's Jack the Ripper. You know what I'm saying? It would take an awful lot to convince. Some people are extremely easily convinced. And then others, like myself, I can't imagine myself being convinced beyond doubt of someone's guilt. It would take some it could happen, but it would have to be, there would have to be evidence that I don't currently know about come forth to convince me of that. And I haven't seen that yet. But my instinct, but Charles LeGrand is probably the single best suspect ever. And no one knows that right now because my book isn't written. When they read it, they'll go, oh, I see what he's talking about. So there you go.
That's fascinating. We'll look forward to your book regarding Charles LeGrand. And I want to say, too, I agree with you that if you were to put all of the things that I ever read, and I'm no Ripperologist expert whatsoever, but just from the more I read, it seems to be more suspect. As you say, it seems to be more complex. And that's not surprising to me for a 126-year-old cold case, let alone something that's 15 or 20 years, never mind 125 years. And a lot of the records were destroyed. A lot of stuff was pilfered, like you mentioned in the book. Things were stole as souvenirs. So there isn't a complete story. And lot, like you say, lies were built upon other lies and or perpetrated and or repeated. So you did an incredible job digging through all of that stuff and then coming to some at least juncture where we can at least decide, okay, this is what he's saying about this particular victim and the connection between these murders based on the Flower and Dean address and some of the other things. So just a fascinating read. You bring the reader right into London in 1888. And I applaud you on a great book and very fascinating take on another aspect of the Jack the Ripper saga in this, the bank holiday murder. So I want to thank you very much, Tom. For those that might want to contact you or learn more about this, tell us how they might contact you or learn more about this book and more about what you do regarding Jack the Ripper. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, if anyone wants to check out the bank holiday murders, yeah, the full title, by the way, is The Bank Holiday Murders, The True Story of the First Whitechapel Murders. It is available through Amazon.com, Amazon.co.uk, and wherever you happen to live and have an Amazon. I have it available in Kindle format, pretty cheap, actually. Right now, in American dollars, it's $4.99. And you can also get the paperback through Amazon relatively inexpensively. If you want to contact me, my website is ripperbook.com. You can go on Facebook and find me at facebook.com/ripperbooks with an S at the end. And then I don't really tweet much. I don't fully understand what that is, but I have you can find me at Ripperbook. And then I also moderate the busiest Jack the Ripper page on Facebook. If you just type in Jack the Ripper, you'll find the Jack the Ripper community on there with like 1,500 members, and just sign up, and you'll catch me on there along with a number of other names you'll recognize from the books on your shelf.
Oh, fantastic. I want to thank you very much, Tom, for this interview, and you have yourself a great evening, and hope to hear from you again real soon.
Hey, appreciate it, Dan. And I look forward to continuing to listen to your awesome show.
Thank you very much, Tom. Best of luck with your next project, and hope to hear from you soon. Good night.
You got it. Bye.